influence has declined since the beginning of the century. And the question is this a trend we can reverse?
We are concerned with making money. That is what we're trying to do.
It's been described as the most beautiful terrace house in London.
The abuse of business and financial power.
You lied.
We shall have a harder Christmas than we have known since the war.
Economic activity is best left to the private sector, with market forces being encouraged to operate.
In the 1950s, Britain was dominated by a small group of men, the captains of industry. They were eminent industrialists and bankers who met together at the court of the Bank of England.
The court opens with the traditional reading of names, and the wide experience available to the bank is apparent.
Mr. Cobbold, Mr. Miners, Sir Charles Hambrough.
Senior director, merchant banker.
Sir John Henry Williams.
Chairman of Courtaulds.
Mr. Cadbury.
Industry, newspapers.
Lord Kindersley.
Chairman of Rolls-Royce, merchant banker.
Mr. Babington Smith.
Banker and industrialist, Middle East.
Mr. Ely.
Steel and chemicals.
Men like these were powerful because of the vast industrial empires they controlled. They worked in partnership with the politicians to shape the future of the nation. But what these men did not realize was that within 15 years, their whole world would be destroyed. Their power would be taken away from them, and their factories torn down and sold off. And the man who began their destruction was a suburban accountant called Jim Slater. To do it, Slater awoke a force that had been dormant since before the war, the stock market. And as he grew powerful, Slater became an ally of politicians. But what neither he nor they realized was that the force he had awoken would overwhelm all of them. In 1959, the Conservatives, led by Harold Macmillan, prepared for an election. The Tories had been in power for over 8 years, but they were confident they would win yet again. The reason was the economic boom they had created, along with the slogan, "You've never had it so good."
Chancellor, it's really you who've really been the base on which we've done all this, because somehow or another, partly by good luck, but I think by good management, we seem to have suddenly, last few months, got into a position quite different which we've ever had since the war. Somehow or another, we've brought off what I called the other day two doubles. We've had, for the first time, steady cost of living for 18 months.
Going on, too, I think, stability.
I think it will. Mm-hmm. You go to get the figures and you can see. Well, then the other thing at the same time, we've had full employment. We've got full employment and steady prices. Well, all I can say is, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Derry, you keep on at that work and it'll be all right.
The Conservatives had created the boom by following the ideas of the economist Maynard Keynes. He had shown politicians that it was possible to manage an economy by varying the levels of government spending and taxes. It was an idea that suited perfectly the patrician outlook of both the Tory politicians and the captains of industry. It allowed them together to create a stable, predictable Britain under their control.
I think Keynesian economics fitted in extremely well with the patrician attitude of politicians.
In what sense?
Well, they had the feeling of being men of with responsibility and feeling that they had to do something for their fellow men and responsibility for their fellow, responsibility for their soldiers, for their tenants, you name it, or the less fortunate ones. They really embraced this policy as a way in which they could, from government, do something to help people. that it was within the power of government to control the economy.
The boom had the required effect, and Macmillan was returned to power. But one of the other effects of pumping this money into the economy was to create a boom on the stock market. The stock market was something that frightened both the politicians and industrialists, because it was unpredictable and threatened their control over the economy. Both lived with the terrible memory of the crash of 1929 and the unemployment it had caused. And as the boom continued to grow and began to excite the public interest, the Bank of England became worried.
Why did the governor of the Bank of England, I think last November, express disquiet at this boom?
Well, I don't really know what was in the governor's mind, but it's always slightly dangerous if the stock market moves ahead very fast. People get tempted into it on the belief that it's going to go on going up indefinitely and sometimes overextend themselves, and then the stock market falls again and people get hurt.
One of the people tempted by the boom was Jim Slater. He was an accountant who worked for Leyland Motors, but he was also fascinated by games and how to predict their outcomes. He decided to try and work out a way of predicting which shares would go up and which would go down.
Well, thanks very much. Good game.
I, first of all, for about a year, ran my own portfolio, had stunning results, and then I suggested to Nigel Lawson, who was the editor of the Sunday Telegraph at the time, that I could write a column and under the pseudonym of Capitalist. And I did that for 2 years, about 2 years, and the market during that time went up 3.6%. And the portfolio went up 69%. So it proved the point.
Slater's column was a great success. As Capitalist, he became famous as someone who understood the workings of the market. And in 1964, Slater formed a company with a young Tory MP called Peter Walker. Slater Walker was an investment company, and as the market continued to boom, Slater became rich, managing other people's money. But as he researched into companies, Slater discovered a hidden secret about many of the captains of industry. They didn't actually own their companies. Over the years, shares had been sold off, and the founding families no longer had a majority shareholding. Their claim to power, he found, was a fiction.
There was still the feeling that son followed father. Families perpetuated themselves in running businesses, and that's the way it was and how it should always be. But in effect, the world, mainly Slater Walker, found that was not so, that basically companies were owned, those that were listed public were owned by shareholders, and in many cases the families only had a very small shareholding, and therefore they were open to change from the outside. And this is what Slater Walker did.
This is a very fine example of a cork tree. It used to be right on the edge of the road, right at the edge of the property, with the canteen just beside it, and it's in very good nick. It's obviously not been hit by traffic or anything. Presumably, it was in danger of being hit by traffic, otherwise they wouldn't have put this big, hefty fence around it. And this is a real cork tree. The cork products we made were seals and gaskets of every sort and kind, and we made thousands of those, I mean millions of them. We'd have orders from all over the world, 40 or 50 million at a time, and we'd have machines that were stamping them out all the time. You went into the machine rooms where there'd be 50 machines doing this, knocking out these damn little things.
Cork manufacturing was run by Colonel Coote. The Coote family had founded the company 70 years before. And as the largest local employer, the Colonel always opened Chingford's fate every year. But Jim Slater had discovered that the Coote family no longer had a majority shareholding, and he decided to try and take the company over.
I went down to see the man who was the chairman. His name was Colonel Coote. And he said to me, his first words, he said, you can't take this over. This is a family company. And I said, well, no, I said, you're wrong. I said, this is a public company in which your family happens to have an interest.
Slater came in and made his bid across the table. My father wasn't the slightest bit interested. He just told Slater to go to hell. He wasn't interested. Slater was half his age. My father was a military man, or had a military background. And I think he was horrified to think this young man had the audacity to suggest that he might take over Cort manufacturing.
I mean, he was, in a way, typical of a large number of people running family companies that have become public but still go on treating them as if they are family businesses. I'm just going to pause for a minute because I want a cup of tea, if I may.
Whereas you were saying what?
Well, people put money up for the shares, don't they? They expect a reward.
Jim Slater then did something that had hardly ever been done in Britain before. He made a hostile takeover. He went behind Colonel Coote's back and secretly began to buy up Cork's shares in the stock market at a very high price. To the city establishment, it was an outrageous and an ungentlemanly act. But there was nothing they could do to stop him. And as Slater bought the shares, he ruthlessly exposed the illusion of Colonel Coote's power. Coote's position as a local dignitary and the respect he and his family received from the workers all came from the belief that he owned the company. And Slater suddenly showed he didn't.
When the takeover happened, I was walking back to my office from somewhere in the factory, and up until that moment, people would have said, good morning, Mr. Andrew. Good morning, Mr. Andrew. How are you, Mr. Andrew? Did you have a nice weekend, Mr. Andrew? What did you do this weekend, Mr. Andrew? At that day, nobody said anything. Until that day, I thought that everybody is making a fuss of you because they like you, because they like you as a chap, which is quite important. When you're in that position, you want people to like you as a chap for what you are. And of course, it's a fallacy. Of course they don't. I don't like anybody else in a similar situation.
Why did they like you then?
Because I was my father's son.
To fund the takeover, Slater had borrowed a great deal of money. To pay it back, he immediately sold off large parts of the land and the factories. They were demolished for property development. Slater had invented a formula which he now repeated. The sales of assets from each takeover were then used to fund the next and bigger one. He took over companies that made metal windows, rubberware, car seats, even bedroom slippers. And soon, others began to copy him. A group of takeover men grew up who began to break up the old paternalist world that dominated British industry.
The comfortable scene that these people broke in on was too comfortable, was old-fashioned, was uncompetitive, was cartelized and convenient for the people who were running it. Needed breaking up, was breaking up. It needed something vulgar like market forces breaking into it. That kind of thing is often caused to happen by rather vulgar people. It's not the worse for that. But of course, there were some real spivs of different kinds among them. Of course there were.
Was Slater a spiv?
Yes, I think he was.
This is the great room, or the saloon, as they called it in the 18th century. Remarkable room, built with an extravagant design. All the panels on the ceiling were painted by William Kent himself, and are the love life of the gods of ancient Greece.
The social centre for the takeover men was the Claremont Club, a gambling club in Berkeley Square in Mayfair. It was run by a right-wing aristocrat, John Aspinall. He was a ferocious professional gambler, and those he admired and let into his club were people he described as risk-takers.
Some people actually seek risk, and they put themselves at risk voluntarily. And I think this is a spirit that is to be admired. I think it's the spirit that built the prosperity that everybody in this country is enjoying today. It was created by adventurers, by merchant adventurers, by pirates, if you like Morgan and Drake.
£200. £200. Card, please.
A card.
Six. We'll have a bet of £50, please.
The Claremont was considered to be fast. In one word, fast. Gambling, up all night, kept odd hours, you know, didn't do a regular 9 to 5 and yet still managed to make millions, which slightly annoyed some people. Nouveau riche businessmen were forming a new set in society which had their, it was like a separate court, a separate set, which flourished on its own. And attracted fairly fast girls, of course, who were mostly after the money, the rich men, the diamond necklaces and all that.
Someone's telling me that you won £1,000 playing this game.
Well, I have done, but not for myself, for somebody else, you know? Because I can't afford to play with that sort of money.
Well, how does playing with other people's money compare with playing with your own?
Well, in a way, it's more exciting because you can imagine it's your own, and you can do many more things that you wouldn't dare do with your own money. You know, if a bank comes up for £100 and you really feel that it's going to win with your own money, you wouldn't dream of doing it because you can't afford to lose £100. At least I can't. With somebody else's, you know, you don't worry.
How old are you?
Me? I'm 20.
The other dominant member of the Claremont set was James Goldsmith. He had briefly been famous in the 50s when he had eloped with a Bolivian heiress called Isabel Patino. She later died in childbirth. Goldsmith now became a close friend of Jim Slater's.
Jimmy Goldsmith and I were great friends. We used to dine together and play backgammon together very frequently. He was, I think it's fair to say this, better educated, more cultured, from a more cultured background, and more of a bon viveur, really, as well. But in terms of business, we were very similar. We were definitely, for want of a better word, hungry.
Slim and fit.
Goldsmith specialised in targeting food companies. His first success was Slim Sear, the makers of a slimming bread. He immediately sold off many of its assets.
Keep you slim and fit.
But, I mean, he immediately got rid of Trendy and he got the whole thing for nothing. So, I mean, it was a very good deal. And then it was one of many. And I remember at one time, he had Slim Sear bread, Pro Sear bread, he had Elizabeth Shaw chocolates, he had Carson's chocolates, he had that excellent water biscuits, I still use them, what are they from? Carr's water biscuits, Jacob's water biscuits, Holland's toffee, and Singleton and Cole snuff, I never use that. But I mean, he had so many products you see all around you. And he had Chewits. And when he bought Chewits, he said, do you know, Aspers, 40 million Chewits a week are consumed in this country. And I said, what is a Chewit?
Chewits, even chewier than a 15-story block of flats.
I think Goldsmith wanted power. I think that Goldsmith was, as a personality, by far the most powerful of them all. A formidable enemy, a ruthless combatant. There is a story of Goldsmith at school which I'd like to bring into this because I think it's to do with the character of the man. He was a turbulent schoolboy, to put it mildly, didn't get on with his housemaster, but when the time came for him to leave early, he turned up in the housemaster's study and said, I know we haven't always got on, but I don't want to part on bad terms. I've got a present for you. It's the complete recording of The Marriage of Figaro, which in those days was on Fragile 78 records. Housemaster quite melted at this. Reached out for the parcel, and Goldsmith dropped it. competent man, a man who didn't believe that you shouldn't kick a fellow when he was down.
To the establishment, the Claremont Sat were a group of destructive gamblers. They were tearing up British industry and fueling a dangerous boom in the stock market. The journalist Paul Johnson wrote, "They are squirming social scum, typical of the rottenness that is poisoning British society." But to one group in Britain, they were heroes. These were the growing suburban middle classes who were now investing heavily in the booming stock market, and in turn, giving Slater and the others their growing power. To them, Jim Slater was the master of the market.
People like Slater awakened the power of the stock market. He created tremendous excitement, sent share prices roaring, focused attention, national attention on the stock market. It was the story of the day.
What power did he have personally?
He had immense power in that, with a word, he could move markets up or down. It was quite a frightening power, probably frightening to him too, I would have thought. He had to be very careful about what he said. But he knew that if he bought a share, the share would go up. And that's a pretty good way of printing money.
But Jim Slater was about to stop being a despised outsider. Politicians were going to turn to him for help and make him an influential force in British politics.
There's one basic fact. Labour has a clear majority. We have a Labour government.
In 1964, a Labour government had been elected. They came to power promising to create a modern, prosperous Britain. But almost immediately, they were faced with a crisis. The boom that the Tories had begun 5 years before had gone out of control. British industry simply couldn't cope with the demand created by the boom. The new government faced growing inflation and a balance of payments crisis. They had to cancel many of their election promises and cut spending.
I would appeal to people to give the Prime Minister a hearing and not these exhibitionists who follow him from hall to hall.
But our old friends return to the purpose of this meeting. Everything in our programme has been costed and is included within the programme of our national plan, within our tightly controlled and rigidly expended government expenditure programme for the next 5 years. Now, we have some very difficult years ahead of us. I hope no one is going to deny that now.
The fundamental problem, the politicians believed, was productivity. If they could make industry more efficient, the economy would grow and Britain would become rich again. What was needed was a quick way to reorganise industry. At this point, Jim Slater emerged as a public figure. He portrayed himself as a new kind of industrial manager. Unlike the old captains of industry, he was not concerned with the national interest. He was only concerned with making a profit.
You are, in a sense, a new breed of person in British industry, aren't you? Now, you don't deal with any one thing other than money, really. I mean,
that is, in a sense, our product.
How do you mean?
Well, we are concerned with making money. That is what we are trying to do. I regard my prime job, if I can put it that way, as a responsibility to my shareholders to provide for them an increasing return per annum on their capital employed. And this, to my mind, is what it's all about.
What Slater argued was that he was using the stock market as a tool to reshape industry. He sold off any part of a company that didn't make a healthy profit. What remained automatically became more efficient. And he pointed to his phenomenal growth in profits to prove this. What Slater seemed to have invented was a way of increasing productivity without having to invest any money. He was no longer a wrecker of industry, he was its saviour.
And Slater had been seen as a pirate, truth to tell, a trampler of the established order. But of course, by this time, perhaps it was a good idea to trample the established order, make it leaner and fitter, and all the sort of jargon that people put round at such a time. And here also were people who were regarded, and Slater is the classic example, as wizards. They looked like agents of industrial reconstruction. And it's worth reminding ourselves that the government at the time, the Wilson government, a Labour government, had an industrial reorganisation corporation going on at the time, actively backing takeovers, having preferred favourites. It's also worth remembering that the minister in charge was Tony Benn.
The Labour government copied Slater's methods. Under Tony Benn's guidance, they masterminded massive takeovers and mergers in British industry. Old companies were forced together to make new conglomerates. Upper Clyde Shipbuilders was created on Clydeside. And in the process, as with Slater's takeovers, thousands of workers were sacked.
For the people, some people here, some here at this meeting, there will be an opportunity of a transfer. For others, there will not. And to be unemployed is bad enough at any time, but it's a great deal worse, in my opinion, at a time like the present, when people not only feel that in losing their jobs, they are losing their income, but it is, of course, the feeling of hopelessness that comes with us.
It wasn't just shipbuilding. British Leyland was formed by the forced merger of old car companies. And AEI was created out of the electrical industry. In the process, thousands of workers were put on the dole. But journalists and television commentators supported this wave of sackings. They accepted Jim Slater's line. These were necessary casualties in a war to make Britain great again.
Is this just then one of the facts of life of the present situation, that as British industry gears itself up to meet world competition, some of these people have just got to go to the war?
I think that is true. I think it's an analogy, really, of there are a certain number of people in a boat, like 100 people, and the boat's going to sink unless two or three of them volunteer to jump off the edge.
Like the way you call it, volunteer.
Well, they might be draw lots for it.
I thought he was credible. And I think I bought the Slater story, which was that he had at least the gift to wake up boring companies, of which there always are plenty, and there were plenty then. I think we swallowed it whole. I say we. I think a lot of people in my business as financial journalists swallowed it whole. I began to realize that I and other people in the financial press were willing dupes. I'm laboring this. It's a bit on my conscience.
In fact, there was very little evidence that any of the companies that Slater took over had become more productive. Almost all the increase in profits he reported came from the stripping out and selling off of assets. Slater and the other takeover men were not the saviours of industry they pretended to be.
They liked to pretend that they went in as some sort of consulting group and restructured industry. They didn't. They ripped it apart and sold off the assets and destroyed industry. They weren't interested in the regeneration of Britain. They were interested in making as much money as they could, by any means. Slater was beginning a tremendous process of change, which has ended with the destruction of large parts of British industry. Because the assets of industry were taken, and perhaps rightly so, but were taken and were used for other purposes.
The wave of takeovers created by the Labour government had little or no effect on productivity. The British economy stubbornly refused to grow. But the takeovers were having a hidden, revolutionary effect on the structure of power in Britain. Both Slater and now the politicians were liquidating many of the assets of industry. They were feeding them as cash into an ever-booming stock market. In future, it would be the millions of small shareholders who would decide where that money should go. The market was now increasingly shaping the future of the economy, not the politicians. And the men who appeared for the moment to control the market were the tycoons from the Clermont Club. And the tycoons were about to be joined by a new, even more ruthless member. He too was going to use the growing power of the market to build an empire. But not in Britain, in Africa. And yet again, he was going to deceive politicians.
I have it in command from the Queen to read to you the following message from Her Majesty. As you assume the heavy responsibilities of independence, I send my good wishes for a great and noble future.
Through the 1960s, Britain gave independence to her former colonies in Africa. But what was left behind were hundreds of plantations, factories and mines, all still owned and run by the British. They had provided the wealth of the empire. Into this world came a new type of entrepreneur. He was called Tiny Rowland. And he ran a small mining company called Lonro. Rowland was convinced there was a fortune to be made in independent Africa. And he was going to do it by taking over Britain's old colonial industries. And what's more, the new African leaders would help him do it.
At the time, all the established companies in Africa were pulling out because of the political situation and other problems there. And he just moved in and bought them up for a song, virtually. I mean, when Rowland took over Lonro, it was a very sleepy little company, but within 2 or 3 years of Rowland appearing on the scene, it escalated beyond all recognition. He was quite amazing, the deals he did.
The potential of, in those days, black Africa was huge. And I wanted to become involved.
When you say potential, do you mean the potential for making money or for diversifying your interests, for having power? In what terms do you talk about potential?
Not in terms of making money alone or having power. That never occurred to me. The excitement, the interest which I thought I would be acquiring, The people I would be able to meet, the vast openings on the continent, these were the ones which attracted me most of all.
The takeover that made Rowland powerful in Africa and in Britain came in 1968. He used ruthless methods to get hold of the richest gold mine in the world, the Ashanti gold mine in northern Ghana. It had been run by a British company for over 80 years, and the chairman was a famous war hero, General Edward Spears. He lived in colonial splendour at the centre of the mine. He had his Rolls Royce shipped out, and every week fresh grouse was flown from London. To the African miners, he was their ruler.
Now, this group of pictures here, I think, are of the more of the mine workers. This man has obviously just come off shift. But I'd rather think this was one of the mine policemen. And then the two dear old men up here who worked more distantly for the mines, I think. I think that these pictures really represent the people over whom Spears had great control and was more or less a patriarch. And I think they show that the Ashanti were very fine people who Spears respected tremendously, and equally they respected him.
There was no way Rowland could buy Ashanti outright. He couldn't raise enough money. So secretly he flew to Ghana to see the country's new rulers. He offered them a deal. Instead of being exploited by the old colonials like General Spears, He would run the mine in partnership with them. All they had to do was to cancel Spears' lease on the mine and give it instead to him. He also allegedly gave them money. They agreed. When the news that the lease was being terminated was leaked to the London Stock Exchange, the price of Ashanti's shares crashed, and Roland moved in and bought the company for a song.
Tiny Roland really squared the Ghana government so that Spears couldn't resist the takeover bid and eventually felt it was in the best interest of his shareholders to accept Tiny Roland's offer. The impression I got was that he was extremely able and very ruthless tycoon, really.
Roland now flew round Africa in his private jet, doing similar deals and building a vast industrial empire for himself. To the African politicians, he presented himself as a new partner, building with them a modern industrial Africa. But like Slater and the other takeover men, he was deceiving them. Roland was stripping as much of the profits out of the companies as he could and feeding it back into the London stock market. In turn, his share price went up and he could do more takeovers. It was growth by acquisition, not by investment.
The country was really being cheated. It's millions of dollars.
And where did that money go?
It definitely didn't come to Zambia. It went to Lono.
To Lono?
Yes.
What's your reaction about that?
I'm furious.
Who do you hold responsible for that?
All those people who perpetrated such an empire and such a trail of betrayal.
Betrayal?
Yes, for development program of the country.
Tiny Roland says he loves Africa.
Because Africa has enriched him, so he would love it. He definitely loves it because it has enriched him. The relationship between Tiny Roland and African presidents is not really sincere and honest. It's the relationship between the rider and the horse. It's the rider who benefits. I don't think the horse benefited at all.
Roland just wanted power. He just wanted to control events and people. And I think money as well, of course. You can't do either of those without the third of those. But he just... wanted complete power over his domain. He would lie, he would put one person against another, he would do anything to achieve his aim.
Tiny Roland now became a close friend of Jim Slater and the other takeover tycoons. They dined together at the Claremont and sold each other companies. All of these new tycoons were making fortunes by tearing up an old system of industrial power that had dominated Britain and its empire for over 100 years. But they were about to become even richer and even more powerful. And yet again it was to happen by accident, as the politicians desperately tried one more time to make Britain's ailing economy grow.
The Queen has asked me to form the next government. And I am indeed proud to accept. To govern is to serve. This government will be at the service of all the people, the whole nation.
In 1970, the Conservatives were returned to power, led by Edward Heath. Heath presented himself as a new kind of politician. He rejected the Keynesian idea that governments could control the economy. He would give up government intervention in industry and let the lame ducks go to the wall. It was the Thatcherite philosophy, 10 years ahead of its time. But the consequences were terrifying. Within months, scores of factories closed and unemployment soared. And in 1971, Rolls-Royce, Britain's most famous company, declared it was bankrupt. Heath decided the experiment had failed. The government would reassert control over the economy.
We are not prepared to tolerate the human waste and suffering that accompany persistent unemployment. We stand by those words today. The measures we have taken this year are proof of our determination to expand the economy, but to do so on sound foundations and to bring down the level of unemployment.
Heath now went to the other extreme. He poured money into the economy. He increased government spending and relaxed borrowing. It was called the Dash for Growth.
Yes, Jim, over.
55,000 Prunia, 25, please, over.
I confirm you want to buy 55,000 Prunia.
But much of the money went into creating a stock market bubble that did nothing to make industry more efficient. Above all, it was invested in the new companies of the takeover men. And Jim Slater's share price soared to astounding heights.
Well, the year is 25, I'd offer you 50 at the moment.
It was a pretty heady time, really. The stock market always went up. I know stories of people going into the old stock market where you walked onto the floor and they saw shares like Slater Walker and so on there and bought for themselves, not for their clients, some shares, went to the loo and come back and they'd sort of made about 25% on their money. And so they sold them again and made profits. Well, the trouble is you can't, that's not reality. No company can move in value like that. So you're actually getting a bubble.
Well, then if you bought the shares, they were bound to go up. So you didn't do anything, you just bought the shares and they went up. For some of these people, some of the great names, and that expectation allows them to use the share, the increased share price, allows them to use the share to go and buy something. Because shares are nothing more than sort of supercharged pounds, really. You can use them to buy other companies.
Which they did.
Which they did. And you can use them to raise more money in the stock market.
Using the power of his extraordinary share price, Jim Slater now became the dominant force in the City of London. He set up his own banking operation and a network of satellite companies, each of which set about asset stripping British industry. He gave thousands of pounds to the Tory party, while his former partner, Peter Walker, became a cabinet minister. Jim Slater was now all powerful.
I did become a bit arrogant, I think, about what I was doing, the business side. I would say. Probably still am.
What do you mean?
Well, I think if you're reading in the press things like this, the master has just done this, and, you know, how wonderful it all is, and how clever it is, and all that, you keep reading it, in the end you sort of start to believe it. You begin to feel you're walking on water a bit. It was thin ice, in fact.
How dangerous was that for you?
It's not desirable, is it? It's going to end up in some sort of problem.
Jim Slater became a partner of the politicians. Ted Heath invited him to become an unofficial advisor to the government. And the Whiz Kids, who ran his satellite companies, portrayed themselves as new kinds of industrialists. They were working with government to reconstruct and modernise Britain.
Well, I think we're very much the sort of company that has evolved as part of Ted Heath's government, which is pretty radical in its approach, is trying new methods, is trying new ways of doing things, and for the most part has been very successful. I think, in fact, this is actually the solution to the British problem, if you like. Throughout the UK, you could release half the assets, half the work staff of just about every company, and you would suddenly, of course, double your gross national product.
The takeover tycoons had finally supplanted the old captains of industry. They had forged a new partnership with politicians. But what few people realised was that their success was based on a facade. They were doing nothing to reconstruct British industry. They were merely profiting from its decline. But drunk on this moment of power, they portrayed themselves as the inheritors of the great industrialists of Britain's past.
If you look back to the great days of British industry, the days when we control 23% of the world's trade, as opposed to about 9% now, when all these great legendary companies were founded, they were all founded, without exception, by capitalists, industrialists, financiers, whatever you want to call them, with a face. Now, all these men who founded these companies were tough, ruthless, ambitious, and not necessarily likable men.
They also forced the captains of industry to bow down to them. Tiny Rowland placed on his board the old establishment figures from each company he bought up. He wanted to display them as trophies.
Drove him? Oh, partly. Partly. Money thing. Partly to beat the likes of us, I think. You know, he didn't like, didn't really like us much. And by us, I mean the establishment. If you look at his most extraordinary thing, the odd thing is he liked Etonians, and he had umpteen Etonians on his board, stiff with them. I can't think why, but he did. But he wanted to sort of, I don't know, beat us, I suppose, I mean, at our own game or somebody's game.
Well, he was just buying them. He was just using them. And the oak, it's amazing how these people would react to a motor car or a trip abroad or a night out or a flat or something. I was amazed because I would have thought they'd be above that sort of thing. They were all sort of blue-blooded, top-notch people, and yet they would still want a free ride.
Why does everybody call me Big Ed? Why do they take the mickey out of me? Everywhere I go, they call me Big Ed! It isn't very nice, you must agree. I don't know how I got the name of Big Ed. It's a puzzle that I never could define. 'Cause nearly all the folks who call me Big Ed have got bigger heads than mine.
But the tycoon's brief moment of power was about to be destroyed. By 1973, it was clear that Heath's dash for growth had failed. It had created rampant inflation, and when the government tried to hold down wages, it led to violent strikes. The politicians privately believed they were losing control of the country.
It seemed to me the government had lost control and wanted to give in, but didn't know how to give in, and that it was the proof of something, which an idea which was becoming quite prevalent among some of us, that whatever the government did, the trade union power was too strong to be effectively countered. That sense of pell-mell of things crowding in, overpowering even a prime minister who was disciplined and determined to do his best, the crowd of events became too great.
In one last attempt to control the economy, Heath decided to slam the brakes on. He announced an immediate freeze on wages, prices, and profits. The idea that profits would be restricted panicked the stock market, and the bubble finally burst. Share prices began to slide. This was a disaster for the tycoons, because their share price was their only source of power. Goldsmith immediately sold off practically all his companies, as did Jim Slater, but he found it more difficult.
Unfortunately, we were in a lot of our liabilities, on property in particular, were difficult to get out of. So although I could see it coming, I was selling off companies left, right and centre. But in the end, I was stuck, for want of a better word.
Tiny Rowland was also stuck. Try as he could, he found it impossible to siphon enough profit out of his African companies to support his share price. So he created fake profits.
The profits of Lonro were, of course, what Rowland did was, with all the companies, all these 300 companies, where they traded with each other, and a lot of them did a lot of intercompany trading, he just added all the sales figures together and consolidated them in one set of accounts, which were produced in London for the Stock Exchange, of course.
Well, we've just had the quarterly figures of Lonro, which is one of our mining companies, and the figures are entirely in line with our expectations. They have made no announcement about nothing at all. No, it's
it looks like a very encouraging report. Call them better on it. Call them 71.3.
71.3.
Yeah.
Good news every time. Wonderful news. Bigger profits, bigger turnover, and so on.
It wasn't true.
On the whole, no, it wasn't true. It wasn't true. It was false reporting.
At this point, the establishment decided to turn and fight. The old directors Roland had placed on his board as trophies were told by the accountants about the false profits. They also discovered that Roland had made secret payments to an ex-Tory minister called Duncan Sands. Roland had bribed him to become chairman and make Lonro look respectable. To the old directors, this was corrupt, and they voted to sack Tiny Roland as chief executive.
They waited for an opportunity when Mr. Roland was out of the country, traveling the African and the Gulf States, and it was only when I overheard a telephone conversation in the suite that Mr. Roland was out having a meeting between a lawyer, a young lawyer, and some people in London, that I thought something was awfully wrong. And upon Mr. Roland's return, I told him that I had a feeling something was going to happen in London.
Roland arrived back to find there had been a boardroom coup. He was no longer in control of his company. The Lonro affair also became a political scandal. Roland came to symbolise the hidden corruption and fakery of the takeover tycoons. The politicians took their anger out on Roland as the symbol of a group of sleazy nouveau riche businessmen who had tricked them. In Parliament, Edward Heath called him the unpleasant and unacceptable face of capitalism.
We have already set in hand an inquiry into the Lonro Company. Where abuses become apparent, we shall introduce reform. We shall bring forward a new Companies Bill in the next session of Parliament. Where unfairnesses exist in our society, we shall do our utmost to correct them.
Do you regard anything of what has happened as unacceptable?
In what particular way?
Anything that has been brought to light as a result of the Lonro affair, do you find any of that in any way the unacceptable face of capitalism?
I can't judge, because this has now escalated into a political matter, and I know so little about politics here that I just can't comment.
But Roland decided to fight. He was convinced he still had one group of supporters left. They were the thousands of small shareholders. He summoned an EGM, an extraordinary general meeting, to ask the shareholders to vote for his reinstatement. He had made them rich. Now they must come and save him.
We walked in by the back door, and we sat in the sort of front row, when I say the front row, where the board would be, I mean the sort of... Then it started, and they all, I can't remember what resolutions were put, obviously, and they all voted for Tiny, simple as that.
Why did they vote for Tiny?
Why? Well, I told you already, he made them a lot of money, and he's making them a lot of money, and they were all little men, or mostly, and so... They were.
What do you mean, little man?
The little chap who has 1,000 shares or something, you know, or maybe 2,000, and goes to an EGM. And, you know, that's big stuff for him.
After the meeting, all of the directors that opposed him seemed to have suddenly disappeared and were never heard of again. In any context, not in Lonro.
He'd won
big. Yes, they disappeared from the stage as if shut down one by one, like a turkey shoot.
I knew it was going to happen. I was thinking, where would I go and have tea? Simple as that.
Like a flash of lightning on a dark night, Roland's victory showed where power had now shifted in Britain. The old captains of industry and the politicians had reunited to try and defeat him and everything that he represented. But Roland had summoned up the power of the stock market and won. But it was a Pyrrhic victory, for an event was about to occur thousands of miles away that would show that no one controlled the market. In 1973, the Arab-Israeli war broke out. One of the consequences was that the Arabs put up the price of oil by 400%. The effect on the Western economies was disastrous. In Britain, the stock market was pushed over the edge into a catastrophic crash. It finally made the politicians realize they had no control over the economy.
As Prime Minister, I want to speak to you simply and plainly about the grave emergency now facing our country. In the House of Commons this afternoon, I announced more severe restrictions on the use of electricity. We are limiting the use of electricity by almost all factories, shops, and offices to 3 days a week. Jobs will be in danger, and take-home pay will be less. We shall have to postpone some of the hopes and aims we have set ourselves for expansion and for our standard of living. We shall have a harder Christmas than we have known since the war.
It was a steeper fall than there had been in this country at the great crash of 1929-31. That was obviously going to wipe out a lot of financiers, speculators, punters, people who'd bought property on borrowed money, people who'd bought anything on borrowed money. But it was more than that. The whole post-war idea that if you got into trouble you could always print a bit more money and it would get you out and get everybody steaming along. That was what collapsed. And with it, the idea that you could manage and manipulate the economy in such a way as to be sure that it always did go steaming along.
As a result of the crash, Jim Slater went bankrupt. He retired to write children's books. Goldsmith and Roland both survived the crash, and they left the country. Roland returned to Africa, and Goldsmith went to America. But both swore they would return and have their revenge on the British establishment.